Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. Now, today I am talking with Rob Clarkson, a Bitcoin educator and merchant adoption facilitator based in the lovely Queenstown, New Zealand. We talk about some of Rob's work running workshops and helping people get their first sats, helping people learn about the Bitcoin network, and even buying their first coffee with Bitcoin at his favorite cafe in Arrowtown. We also discuss merchant adoption, what the opportunities and barriers are to merchants accepting Bitcoin payments in New Zealand, and what the future might look like there. So I do hope you enjoy the show. If you want to support the show, please consider streaming some sats over your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform. Otherwise, on to the show.
A lot of people, myself included, never really was any good at saving until Bitcoin came along, and now Bitcoin has come along. You really start thinking like sort of long term, because you know that every sort of Bitcoin that you spend now is basically the future spending power of that Bitcoin gone for the future, and it really hits home because you'd much rather, you know, fix that. I took some shoes into the shoe shop, and he was like, "Nah, the toast, chuck them out." I was like, "Well, you know, it's only the left one, and it's just split on the sort of the toe bit, you know, where you bend your toe a lot." And he was like, "It'll probably be, you know, probably $40 to fix them." And I was like, "Well, all right, so what else have you got?" And he's like, "Here's some for $80. And I was like, "Oh, I quite like these, and you know, they fit me." And I wouldn't have had that conversation pre-Bitcoin. Maybe I would have been like, "Yeah, okay, I'll chuck them in the bin, give me the $80. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And that sort of thinking, as you say, it changes the way you think about things like that. And I have a lot of respect for repairing things, you know, mending clothing and shoes. You know, there's a certain, I think, respect as well for the craftsmanship that goes into things if you're able to repair it. And I think this, you know, kind of throwaway society we live in is, I believe it has already ended. It's just sort of, it's got so much momentum. And I think zooming out a little bit, looking at the macro climate that we're in, where we're seeing sort of a slowdown in globalization or perhaps even deglobalization, as many people have commented. You know, factories are being pulled out, stuff's being onshored again, you know, with supply chains sort of up in the air. It's actually a lot safer to do stuff locally. And I know for myself, you know, with some of my personal work doing photography and photo books, I used to print a lot of that overseas. But now it's here locally in Wellington. I'm able to do that. And I've kind of really consolidated a lot of that stuff here. Because, I mean, it is still possible to do things like that here. So I think maybe we're going to see a larger trend towards, you know, some of these industries coming back. And maybe it takes a long time. But certainly it's a resilience, which was never, people say it was never priced into the cheap commodities that we had previously. You know, it was all based on just-in-time manufacturing. And that really revealed itself with the whole COVID lockdown situation that just fell over. And so we're kind of dealing with that, I think, as well, in a way. So it seems like many of these kind of moving parts of the deglobalization, the renewed continual development of Bitcoin and greater awareness of the monetary system and how it's sort of flawed, that's all seems to be intersecting pretty much like now. And I think, you know, there's an awareness, which I certainly wasn't aware of, you know, which is, you know, the money printer as a concept, right? I think there's a certain awareness within society that that's a thing, which I certainly, you know, I wasn't thinking about that before Bitcoin, at least. It just wasn't on anyone's vocabulary. We didn't have the language to describe it, you know, just in everyday life. But it feels like, you know, normal people, you know, everyday people are starting to kind of realize that there is a money printer and that someone's in control of it and it's not them.
Totally. And I think the inflation, as a Bitcoiner, used to talk to people about inflation a couple of years ago and they were, you know, kind of glazed eyes. But now, like on the high street in the UK, there was this, you know, a poster from a shop, inflation beating savings, like 2-for-1, beat inflation with these. So it's sort of, you're right, it's kind of coming more into the public vernacular, the terms that people starting to think more about, you know, what's going on with the money and why does money lose this? I think when it loses its spending power steadily over time, it's like the frog in the pot. They don't, you know, you don't notice, but what it's when it starts getting hotter quicker, I think, or starts losing its purchasing power faster, people are like, oh, you know, it really starts to be a talking point.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that when you have it in the media, people may not necessarily acknowledge Bitcoin as a solution, but the fact that it's being put out there and these conversations around cost of living are being put out there, I think in a way, subconsciously, people start to kind of connect the dots and they start to think, okay, there's, you know, prices going up. Why, you know, what's going on here? Where did that money go? Why, you know, why are we short investment in energy and housing and healthcare? What, you know, why do we not have enough nurses? Why are all of these problems? You know, why have my groceries gone up? And they start to kind of mull it over, but they don't necessarily have the ability to consciously connect the dots to say, well, this, okay, I can see that this is connected to that. And I think Bitcoin is kind of, we know that's the answer, but I think at least we can recognize that for the general public, there is an awareness, if only subconsciously, that there is something going on, and starting to bring it around to saying, well, actually, there is a solution to this, because previously there wasn't. I think that's really the big difference we have now, is that we have this thing that people can start talking about and using in small amounts, and starting to realize that there's this kind of the cat's out of the bag. And certainly when I was learning about inflation and economics in high school, and you know, you've got the classic 1-3% target and all of these things, you know, that was a different era. And where we're at now, I just don't know how much more cognitive dissonance you can bring upon the population when prices are just going up and up and purchasing power is going down. You know, at some point people are kind of going to be like, well, what's going on here?
Yeah. One of the things that kind of concerns me is there's the potential for people to point at Bitcoin and blame it for the prices going up, because if Bitcoin is acting correctly and becoming essentially more scarce over time as the inflation rate of Bitcoin drops due to the halvings, then people could point to Bitcoin and go, look, the reason the price of everything's going up is because Bitcoin's, you know, causing it. It's the playbook.
Would that have to be quite a, I mean, I'd have to imagine it'd be a much huger market cap than it is today, and a much higher price for that to start being able to be used as an argument that it's sort of sucking this value out of the system and therefore prices are going up. I mean, I feel like that's, it is possible. I just don't know. It would have to be quite significantly higher price to be, I mean, maybe they could justify it anyway, but
I'm not saying it's going to be like a logical, it's obviously completely illogical, it makes no sense, Bitcoin couldn't cause this, but what's been interesting is we've seen how people have pointed the finger at Bitcoin for causing, you know, climate problems, like Bitcoin's exacerbating the climate crisis, whereas it's a ridiculously small fraction of the total energy usage of the world, and so it's a ridiculous argument. But you know that people, the guys that don't want to lose their power, are going to start pointing the finger to try and point the finger at other places to kind of take the, you know.
I think I hear you. I see where you're going with that. It's sort of this last ditch effort to kind of throw the mud at the wall and see what sticks. And I think we've seen that even with the cost of living. You know, it's like, well, it's the war in Ukraine, it's this, that, and the other thing. It's everything except the money printer. And though there is aspects of, you know, of the basket of prices that have been impacted by the war or supply chains and that sort of thing, really the intransitory aspect of inflation is the money supply has increased. And so even that argument, though, for the general public, I feel is a bit complex to understand. You know, the idea that there is this number, this kind of elastic magical supply of money that just kind of inflates continually, people may not really have an ability to gauge what that even means to them. You know, it's sort of like that, because they're just living it every day, And they're just sort of seeing the symptoms of it, but they can't kind of connect the dots. So yeah, I can appreciate the concern that you could kind of pull the wool over many people's eyes and then have those knee-jerk arguments, sort of like you see with the energy piece, where sort of like, well, you know, these Bitcoiners, you know, they're the ones that you need to be talking to about this inflation thing, even if, as you say, it's completely illogical.
Well, yeah, so the reason I say it is because, I mean, Biden recently with his $1.7 trillion bill, where he's creating money out of thin air, is an inflation beating bill or something. So he's causing inflation to beat inflation, which is just completely, you know, doesn't make any sense at all. So yeah, that's why it concerns me a little bit. But I mean not that much, but there's nothing we can do about that. It's we keep on building, and we keep on, you know, helping people learn and just be prepared for the things like this that could show up, and I guess cross the bridge when we come to it. But
yeah. Oh no, I was just going to say, certainly the what I often come up to when I'm talking to people, you know, today, there is a lot of these kind of what ifs, you know, and I feel like in a way there was a little bit less of that in previous years. And so now, you know, the first barrier that people throw up is, oh, doesn't it use a lot of energy? Doesn't it, you know, isn't it bad? Isn't it used by bad people? You know, there's all these kind of things that are thrown up, and they're sort of these parroted, kind of regurgitated, you know, takes on what it is. And they've been kind of pre-compiled, you know, the idea, the seed has been pre-compiled by the media to you know, to have these responses. Whereas kind of coming at it relatively naive, you say, oh, actually, that sounds really cool, you know, let's give it a go. But whereas today, a lot of people, you know, who otherwise should probably know better, you know, think, well, you know, the government's never going to let it happen. And so there is this kind of educational piece, almost sort of de-educating people, because they've been learning the wrong thing, or they've been taught, or not necessarily taught, but what's been told to them has been incorrect. And I know that's something you're really interested in terms of the educational aspect of Bitcoin. Tell me a little bit more about sort of what you're doing with that.
Yeah, we'll do it. First, you've just jogged my memory about. So one of the things that I'm sort of advocating for now is that we ask every every independent shop that you go to and you buy something from, hopefully it's the owner there at the counter or whatever, and you just ask them, I think the key is to ask them, do you accept Bitcoin? Just open, you know, question, just leave it there and then see what they say. And then that's a touch point for them. And sometimes they might engage, if you've sparked their intrigue, they might ask you a question. And if they don't, you know, don't say anything more about it. And so I've been doing this recently, and I had three memorable ones. One was a kind of a youngish girl who was at the counter, and she was like, no, but we should. And I was like, oh, cool. Awesome. That's a great response. She wasn't the shop owner, so I don't think she was going to make it happen anytime soon, but I was still stoked to that. I had my hairdresser, and he was like, he was all on board with the freedom aspect, but still too complicated and a too hard basket. And but he, like I say, we had a good conversation about it. And then there was a cafe owner in rural New Zealand who just said no. And I was like, okay, this guy, I just walked out. I was like, that's cool, it's all right. I paid my money, obviously. Didn't just walk out without paying. yeah, so I think that's the key, is to just let people know that it's here and you're ready to pay in it. Should they be accepting it? And they're like, well, maybe I should. And then, but you know, if they're not ready to be interested, or they, you know, because at the moment, lots of independent shopkeepers probably quite sort of financially stressed. And so it's not, especially around Christmas time, nobody's really got time to sort of have a yarn with you about Bitcoin too much. So it's sort of a bad time to kind of push it. And I certainly don't recommend pushing it, but I think it's a good thing to just get in the habit of doing as a Bitcoiner, because that's really what got me into Bitcoin, was just these touch points. And yeah, so in terms of, sorry, into this, coming back into your question about the education, yeah, it's something that I taught computing at the Southern Institute of Technology in Queenstown for, I think it was like 4 or 5 years. I quite enjoyed it. It's very rewarding teaching. But I threw the towel in when my own business got quite busy. But then, yeah, I've been teaching Bitcoin as well in Queenstown, just small classes. And we go to a cafe that's that accepts Bitcoin for coffee. And we, I take them through sort of the whole, a broad brush strokes over every aspect of Bitcoin, from how it affects society and what it is, how to use it. We use it straight away. So the first session is using Bitcoin, testnet Bitcoin, then how Bitcoin works. So getting into a bit more into the nitty gritty, but not, you know, not too deep. We don't talk about low level cryptography or anything. Just here's an address, here's a blockchain kind of thing. The Lightning Network. So we use that on the second session, and then how that works. And that's, I use sort of analogies for the Lightning Network. And then I talk about mining and self-custody and using hardware wallets. So it's sort of like a real broad kind of about Bitcoin course. I call it Bitcoin for Beginners. I'm sure some people think it's too advanced. Some people probably think it's too beginnerish, but you know, you can't please everyone. And I think it's a good intro. It's a good holistic intro to Bitcoin. And what I'm actually hoping to sort of,
Oh, no, I was going to say, Rob, what I really like about that is, number one, you've got a background in education and you've been teaching at the Polytech. You kind of understand what goes into a syllabus and how to structure that. And I think that's really important. And so you've been able to break that up into these sections. And I really like that you've got a local cafe that you can do it at too, because I don't actually think we've got anywhere that comes to mind immediately, even here in Wellington. So the fact that you've got a place you can go to in Queenstown and sort of situate it, it really sets the scene. You know, it's not just theoretical. It's like, here, real life, get the wallet, you know, spend the sats and get the coffee. I think that's really great. So is that cafe, is that something that you were able to organize, or were they already Bitcoiners? How did that come about?
Yeah, Alex, big shout out to Alex from Goldie Cafe and Wolf Coffee in Arrowtown. He's like curious, interested in crypto in general, which, you know, I don't begrudge him that at all. And so he got on to me through a mutual friend, Brendan, who suggested to him that he talk to me. And I said, look, the easiest way for you to accept cryptocurrency for coffee is to accept it via Bitcoin over the Lightning Network, because I'd been impressed with the Blue Wallet, which is what I was using to do to teach the Bitcoin with. And so I did a demo for him. Here you go, you install it, you know, sent him some as a test, and he was like, sweet. And so he started doing it. He did it originally in his Goldie Cafe, which unfortunately the mobile signal for the internet is not very good in the cafe. So he's actually stopped in that cafe doing it, but he has Wolf Coffee on the main street of Arrowtown, which has better internet. And so he's happy to do it there, because what he was finding, unfortunately, was people were spending too much time at the counter trying to get signal and unable to pay the QR code, because you need obviously internet to scan the QR code and to sign the transaction. So he moved it out of Goldie Cafe and he accepts it in Wolf Coffee now instead. So I haven't actually paid with Bitcoin at Wolf Coffee yet, but I did in at Goldie Cafe. I asked him if he was going to, because he roasts coffee, he has a roastery. I asked him if he was going to start accepting Bitcoin for payment for his coffee, for his roasted coffee, which I think he ships certainly in the local area. I think he said he was planning on doing that as well, but I'm not sure how far along he is with that yet.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. I think often coffee really comes back to the core of all of this, because I've often thought there's something really social about it, you know, being able to pay for, you know, for a coffee with Bitcoin. But there's also this piece where I've often thought having the ability to engage with the farmers and the growers and their whole supply chain using a Bitcoin standard really opens up some opportunities to, I think, create some real value. And I often think, you know, wouldn't it be great to just be able to find out a bit of the story, maybe, you know, where do the beans come from, you know, what's the grower doing, you know, where are they based, and they've just got a little QR code, static you know, alien QR code that you can throw a few sats to and say, man, you know, this is really great stuff. And it really kind of melts away those borders, which at the moment it's like, well, how else would you even, you know, begin to engage with that person in, you know, whether they're in Brazil or Ethiopia, wherever the grower is based. But it just sort of melts away once you've got Lightning or Bitcoin, you know, in the story. And I feel like there's the ability to have almost like this vertically integrated supply chain where all the way to the actual consumer, you know, in different ways, people are using Lightning and Bitcoin to, you know, Bitcoin over Lightning to pay for this or to engage with it. And once you've got one vertical, then you can start doing other stuff. So it's really exciting. And again, really great to see someone doing that locally. So I feel like that's a really good way to approach it. So when you've done these classes in the past, is it usually like sort of small groups or like one-on-ones? How do you usually do it?
Yeah, so I have maximum 16, I think it's the most I've had in one group, but 10 is more the average. You wouldn't want to fit more than that. And, you know, I try to help everybody out a little bit if they get stuck with the phone. And we've had some disasters with the hardware wallets. So, yes, the iPhone, you can only use Bluetooth to connect to your hardware wallet. And it turns out lots of people using Bluetooth in a small area is not a good idea. So, small classes. And then people can ask. And I love the engagement. So when somebody asks a question, it's my favorite moment because you can tell they've paid attention and they're asking something that surely everybody else wants to know. And we go, if there's a rabbit hole, we go down it. So that's good as well.
I really respect that you're doing that work, Rob. And I think what I really like about it as well is you're actively reaching out to these people, because I think, you're actively engaging with them. You know, they're obviously reaching out to you, but you're working with them to go through the process. And I think that is a huge barrier for a lot of people. It's like, well, where do I start? You know, like you Google some stuff, you sort of search around, and it can actually be also quite dangerous when you're in that kind of naive period where you don't really know, you know, well, what about this other thing, this Ethereum? What, you know, is that what I want to be doing? You know, and people maybe start looking in places where it's actually a little bit risky for them. You know, maybe they sign up to some casino exchange and they throw some decent money down and then they lose it all. You know, there's these real challenges to that. And so what I like is, you know, you sort of taking them back to some fundamentals, and I imagine, you know, refining that course over time as things develop, things like Lightning, maybe, you know, there's more and more that's happening in that space. So having that syllabus and being able to teach, that's really great. Is there anyone else who's doing that with you, or is it just yourself?
Oh, I had my friend Daniel McClure helping me. He's recently had a kid, so he's kind of out of action at the moment, but he was coming down. He's actually really passionate about Ethereum more than Bitcoin, I feel. It's good because you can't just be surrounded by people who agree with you all the time. So I'm kind of always pushing the Bitcoin angle and he's kind of countering with the Ethereum angle, and I don't know, we sharpen our arguments a little bit like that. But yeah. He's kind of passionate about the cryptocurrency space as a whole. I'm probably butchering his reputation here. I apologize, Daniel. No, you're good, mate. I'm only joking. So that's sort of he's passionate about it enough to help me with the course, which is great. So he's happy that, you know, I talk about Bitcoin the way if somebody's interested in some other coin, I say, look, I feel the best thing to do, I don't put them off, I say the best thing to do is probably find out about Bitcoin first before you look into anything else, because it was the original one and all the others kind of spawned out of it. And so, you know, try my best not to tell other people what to do, because it's up to them. That's what Bitcoin's about. It's not about telling other people. It's about giving people all the options and letting them make their own decisions. And so, yeah, we sometimes have a bit of a disagreement in a class. Like, I'll say something and he'll say, no, I don't think that. It's a bit like, but I quite enjoy that, because I also point out to people when I'm teaching Bitcoin, I say, hey, look, this is what Bitcoin means to me. Okay, what I'm telling you right now, and you might disagree with me, and that's fine, because Bitcoin might mean something else to you, and I'm not necessarily right, and you're not necessarily wrong. And I think that's the cool thing about it. It's like, here's what's important to me about Bitcoin, but, you know, other people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, looking at the adoption curve and sort of where we're at, I mean, we have to be real that not everyone is going to learn everything about it and fully internalize the belief system, for lack of a better word, of what it all means. You know, I think that's a certain percentage of the population, and that's really this kind of early adopter trailblazer sort of cohort that I think we're sort of getting towards potentially the end of that. You know, there's people coming in now who will just start using it and not necessarily know all of the troubles that, you know, all of the struggle that went into getting to where we are today. And certainly I wasn't there from the beginning myself, but I kind of appreciate that ethos that went into it. But where you know, you've got maybe someone who's, say, you know, they're working in the cafe and they're just a staff member, they're just operating the phone that the boss set up to do Bitcoin stuff. They don't necessarily need to know anything. They just say, oh, well, that's how we accept payment. I've never heard about any of these other coins being used for day-to-day payments, but Bitcoin certainly, yeah, here it is. And that's a touch point for them. So kind of as the race goes on, and it's not really a race, but as time goes on, you know, the clarity of, well, what's good and what's not starts to really become clear. And I think the macro situation as well, with how, you know, interest rates are going, I think that kind of cheap money that was just sloshing around looking for somewhere to go, you know, and let's make it an NFT and let's make it into this next thing, this ICO, those days are kind of over. And it's still kind of percolating, it's still there, but it's definitely not, I think the high water mark's been reached. And so clearly that's all starting to fall over, and these coins are going back to you know, going to zero, but Bitcoin's still sort of floating along, and, you know, we're just building. And over time, I think people will look at, say, the current cohort of coins and say, well, you know, who remembers the ones from 2017 that all blew up? You know, that half of them are gone. And that will just repeat. And maybe we have another cycle where some of these coins come in and people try stuff out. But I feel like that there will be diminishing returns for people who are looking at that stuff.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, a lot of them are just the founders creating X million of the token, because if the token gains any value at all and they've got, you know, 100 million of them, sweet, they've made a pretty penny. And all they've got to do is dress it up with some kind of half-baked idea about, you know, chickens on the supply, on the blockchain or something like that, or whatever it is.
Well, and I mean, yeah, the chickens in particular. I mean, I have a friend who's actually into that stuff, and I thought, you know what, look, it's a game, you know, it's Farmville. It's a bit of fun. It's not a monetary network. It's not a monetary network for the world. And I think that distinction is starting to become more clear to people. You know, there's the stuff that you can kind of mess around with and get some wearables and NFTs and whatever. And that's over here. And it's half the time it's not really, you know, worth it, but it's never going to be worth it, but it's a thing that you can play with if you want as a casino. And then there's this monetary network that's going to save the world. And I think those two, though blurred together for normal people, I think if you can kind of make it clear that there is a distinction. But
yeah, I think you're right. It's easy to get distracted. And I myself have been guilty of this by all these other things that potentially sound like they could go on a blockchain. But when you come down to it, the base layer of any kind of system where you need to have value being, if there's value being communicated, the base layer of that is who owns what. And Bitcoin nails that every time.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin is the most efficient way of figuring that out. We keep it, it's decentralized, and we keep track of it, and we don't need a central authority. If you need to do anything on top of, if you need to do anything with that, you can build on top of that, because we've already got this decentralized who owns what system layer sorted as best we can. And so you don't need to create your new token out to do this thing, because you don't need a new token. We've already figured the token out, and it's as good as it's going to get. You're not going to make it better, because if you do, Bitcoin will add that better feature. Yeah, if you're trying to do something different, fair enough. Like, maybe you need your own token for doing something completely different. But if there's value, if it's like, here's a token for paying for Wi-Fi, well, that token should be Bitcoin, because that's the value transfer
network
that we have.
I hear what you're saying. I think there's a certain there's a depth to knowing what is involved here that is easy to gloss over. And so from a kind of business perspective, you know, kind of buzzwords, throwing blockchain in there, it kind of, and maybe not so much now, but, you know, maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, it would that would kind of, you know, raise some eyebrows. People say, oh yeah, okay, tell me more about that. You know, because people are looking for the next thing, and quite clearly, you know, the socially, economically, there's been a lot of negative growth, a lot of negative events taking place, leading to slower growth. You know, people are trying to kind of catch up and get ahead of what's going to happen next. And blockchain, AI is the other one that everyone sort of jumps on and say, okay, well, how's this going to change things? And I think that it's almost forgivable to say, look at it and see that a company is maybe looking at some blockchain stuff. Okay, they haven't really done the work though, because I think ultimately when you get down to it, it will always be faster and better to just run a database, or you know, that you manage yourself. Trying to decentralize it, you either go all the way or you don't, and that's I think where the argument starts to fall over. So when it's a buzzword, it can kind of just float in the ether and sort of be this thing that we start, you know, talking about. But when you actually get down to the nuts and bolts of building, you know, I would take a MySQL database any day of the week to run anything over trying to do it on a smart contract, blockchain, whatever. And that's having, you know, myself working with tech as well, you know, I know that, you know, you're not going to be querying that thing at all the speed that you could get on just a normal managed database like we've always done. So that kind of starts to fall over, and so it's like, yeah, it's only really a gimmick. And the gimmick unfortunately has gotten so much kind of attention and investment over the last little while, because again, that money's been sloshing around looking for the next thing, that it's kind of propped it up. And so it's on this you know, this kind of sort of these thousand cushions on top of each other, and it's just sort of floating there with no real foundation. It's just flopping around in the wind, and that's come down, you know. And we've seen that really with the crashes with these you know, with these exchanges and different so-called blockchains kind of going offline. You know, they're not able to even do the function that they were supposed to. So I think there's a certain awareness there that isn't quite, I mean, certainly for us it's clear, but for people who are outside the space, it's not their domain knowledge. You know, maybe they haven't been keeping up with that. And that's, again, it's just an education piece.
Yeah, I agree. I just think it's, I think the problem is that a lot of people don't even fully understand what money is. And this is one of the biggest things. It's sort of what I talk about at the start of the Bitcoin course is, what is money? And the three fundamental properties of money, that it's a store of value, medium of exchange, and a unit of account. And once you understand those a little bit better, and I compare, so on the course I compare gold and fiat with Bitcoin and show how it stacks up. And somebody's already created this sort of chart of, you know, giving it A to Fs for each of them on basically things like divisibility, portability, fungibility, all these kind of different metrics. And I think one of the things we do in New Zealand is we have houses as our store of value. And this is the knock-on effect, obviously, is increased house prices across the board, which it causes another knock-on effect of young people not being able to buy a house or even get on the housing sort of market ladder. And that again is another, we're looking at the symptom here, is like, oh damn, nobody can afford a house. And it's not like we're short of land in New Zealand. We have quite a lot of land. It's sort of like a man-made problem. And I went to a talk in Queenstown, just was something that just caught my interest. I can't remember, was it a friend who suggested it to me? And it was, anyway, I went, it was about securing your future, which I'm interested in, but it was essentially how many houses you need to retire in New Zealand. How many houses do you need to be able to retire comfortably on what income you need in New Zealand? And it's kind of madness, because we need houses to live in. They shouldn't be, they're not supposed to be a store of value. I mean, okay, they do store value, but it's not, you're not supposed to have your house as a store of value. But it turns out there are a good store of value, aren't they? Because they go up so much.
I mean, in lieu of an alternative, but they're not very liquid, and trying to, you know, right now you wouldn't want to be trying to get out of that position and you know, be liquidating your store of value for whatever reason, because you'll probably be sitting on it or taking a price that you're not happy with. So obviously there's some issues there, and absolutely the utility of the house is as a place to live. And so when you monetize that and make that into a store of value, it's sort of like you're using it for something that it wasn't designed for. And there's all of these externalities in society, which I'm certainly my generation are feeling. You know, it's trying to raise a family, trying to have kids. Any of that stuff is very difficult for people who are in their 20s and 30s who, you know, just normal people not making, you know, above average income or anything. Whereas, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you know, everyone could afford a house. And so there's that real difference. And it's interesting because it's happened globally. It's sort of almost symptomatic of this larger global trend, which is sort of this end game of the fiat system. But what I wanted to circle back to was you said you started your course with this what is money question. And I find that very fascinating because I feel like there's almost a language or a way of talking that we need when we come to talking about money. And right now I'm actually reading or rereading Republic, Plato's kind of exploration of justice and all of that. And the sort of Socratic dialogue of how you have a conversation when people may be coming into things with preconceptions is really interesting. And I'm sort of thinking, you know, what are the questions that you can ask? Because if you start telling somebody, well, this is what money is, you know, their eyes maybe start to glaze over, or they kind of look at you a bit funny. But if you really sort of sincerely look at them and you ask them, well, what do you think money is? And then they give you an answer, and then you can kind of start picking it apart. Well, is it cash? You know, money, this is coins and notes. Okay, but what about the money, the so-called money in your bank account? Well, what is that? And then you can sort of go along the dialogue and follow that sort of Socratic process to get to an answer which they've actually formulated themselves. And that can take a long time, and you don't always have the luxury of having someone's attention for that long. But it really, I think, in my experience, having tried to do it quickly, it ultimately lends itself better to being a long format conversation, perhaps split over several meetings with somebody. And you just sort of start with the easy question, the hardest question, which is what is money? And then you slowly kind of work through it, and you keep coming back to it. Oh, you know, here's some cash. You know, well, when was the last time you used cash? You know, everyone uses FPOS in New Zealand. It's like, well, you know, have you seen the money lately? Because certainly the money's changed in form and shape since I was a kid. You know, well, what does that mean? You know, has it lost its value as well? You can start sort of probing them, and they get these touch points, and they start thinking, well, and they can formulate it in their own mind. Because I think everyone is capable of understanding this if given the tuition, but it certainly is a challenge to go through that with everybody.
Yeah, it's high energy, high effort to kind of try and take people on the Bitcoin sort of journey about learning about the what is money journey as part of that. it's a real high effort thing, which is why so when I was back in the UK, a guy said to me, he said, yeah, it's a lot of effort to kind of try and teach people about Bitcoin. So here's what we could do instead: is we could try and get merchants to accept Bitcoin by kind of describing all the fundamental practical features of Bitcoin. You know, instant payment, instant settlement, no chargebacks, all this kind of thing. And I thought, yeah, he's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's
certainly. I think that's an important piece to it. And what I think as well is, again, coming back to Plato, you know, it's like he kind of pre-compiled the concept of justice, and not necessarily freedom, but justice as a base point for this beginning of this kind of Western philosophy, right? I mean, that's a pretty heavy thing to read. You know, it's literally a couple of pages a day sort of a thing. You really go through it slowly. You can't, as I say, can't expect everyone to do that. But what you can do, you pre-compile it, and then they get to just run the binary. You know, they get to just run the thing and click, double click it, and it goes, right? And so we all live in the shadow of, you know, this kind of philosophic thought that was developed thousands of years ago. And there's different threads of it that came through time, but it was built upon, right? It was kind of an open source idea. And so with Bitcoin, it's like, yeah, the very first thing is, well, look, we've kind of already done the thinking, you know, getting someone to hold it. So the first step is like, can you get them on for zero? And one service that I really love that I've just discovered recently is tipcards.io. Have you heard of that? So it's
I have it just through you, I think.
Yeah, just through me. So the it's really great. I recommend everyone give this a go. So this is you just go and you can get these QR codes ready to go, really simple, and you print them out, and then you can just load some sats onto them. And the way it works is when you give it to someone, I've actually got one right here. When you give it to somebody, you just print them off and cut them out. They can scan it, and if the sats haven't been claimed, it takes them to a little page that just says, hey, you know, here's Wallet of Satoshi, you can download it. It's really simple. And then once they've got the wallet, they double click it again, or they click it again, and they can withdraw the sats. And it's Lightning. It'd be a little bit more difficult, I think, if it was base chain, just to kind of go through it. But with Lightning, it's just click and go, and it appears. And I really like that. And I actually gave one to my mother, and she got on it. And then she, you know, she's like, yeah, sweet. You know, went and brought some, and she started to learn about it. And I thought, you know, this is like, you're trying to do this a year ago, 2 years ago, before Lightning was really taking off. It would have been a lot more challenging. But man, I just carry them around in my wallet now. And so I think those barriers are going to go, you know, they're going to continue to lower. And, you know, when you're talking to a merchant, that's the sort of thing. You say, hey, you know, I really appreciate the service, by the way. You know, here's some Bitcoin. You can check it out and learn a bit more. And maybe the next time you go, like, yeah, download Wallet of Satoshi, Blue Wallet. I couldn't quite work it out, though. And then you can sort of come back and say, well, you know, let's have a look, see what's going on here. But you're giving them the opportunity to learn and take it at their own pace, and kind of you're meeting them where they are. And I think trying to, in the past, when I've said to someone, like, look, you know, download it, go, let's do this, you know, right now, right here, I wish someone had said that to me in the old days. But for most people, that's not really the way to do it. I think you've got to sort of let them come to it, and by giving them this QR code that you can print out, I feel like that's kind of a very soft way of kind of onboarding somebody. And if they don't take the sats, you know, you've got a copy of it. You can always sweep them back out and give it to somebody else. So I think more and more of those sort of educational tools will emerge as well in the future.
I like the idea. I think that's great. Giving people Bitcoin is definitely a very powerful thing to do.
Yeah.
Especially because when they've installed the app on their phone, and they can look at it at a later date, or when they've got time, they can do it when they've got time, because right there and then when you meet them, probably the worst time to try and physically go about install this app. Here's scan your QR code. So it's handing them something brilliant.
Yeah. And I really think the UX of that's important. And I think the tipcards.io have really nailed that, because I have seen others try and do it, and it's like, you know, here's the card, you know, you've got to do this. And I think focusing on the seed phrase is been a bit of a thing that gets people. Like, it's like, look, you can't expect people to do that. I think the first port of call has to be Lightning, just Wallet of Satoshi or Blue Wallet maybe. But look, you just want to be able to get in there and get it. And maybe they lose the phone, they lose the 500 sats that you gave them. But I think it really has to be the second or third time that you touch base with that person that you start talking about the seed phrase and the security and all of that stuff. I feel like they need to see the transaction take place and sort of feel it and know that this has happened and I've got the sats to then be able to do the next step. And focusing too much on the other stuff it's good for us technical people, but for normal people, I just don't think it connects. You know, they think, oh, is that my password? Is it my seed phrase? Is it, you know, what does this even mean? I'm lost now. You know, but there's nothing easier than getting the QR code, scanning it, getting the sats and thinking, wow, that was easy. So I'm coming back to that. So you talk about the merchants, you know, you ask every shop you go into, you're saying, hey, do you accept Bitcoin? You've had a few good responses, a few sort of lukewarm ones. Some, you know, were a little bit negative. What do you think, though, in New Zealand in particular, what are the barriers and what are the opportunities to point of sale merchant adoption, and how can we make that happen? What sort of approaches can we take to actually seeing this come to life?
Yeah, I think the biggest barrier is the volatility of the price. I think that's probably the main one, because you don't want to accept $10 in Bitcoin for something for your sale today that it's only worth $9 tomorrow. That's no good, and that's the last thing a merchant wants. And like when they're not orange pilled, they're not going to appreciate the fact that it's, you know, a decentralized sound hard money. They just see that at the end of the day the value's gone down or whatever. If it's gone up, great news. But the risk of the volatility is, I think, the biggest problem for merchants accepting it.
Do you think, though? I mean, 10% drop in a day. I mean, that's pretty. I don't know if that's pretty realistic where we're at today. I mean, I think if you're settling cash, you know, settling it out at the end of the day, I mean, it would be a very marginal difference. I feel like that's something we've talked about previously, which is that sort of cash, or, you know, kind of conversion service where Bitcoin can be accepted on the day to day, but there's a facility, or currently there isn't a facility to cash that back out to fiat for the business owner. And I feel like there's sort of that market gap there where, you know, sure, I'm accepting Bitcoin, but it's actually a real pain to bring that back into fiat. And as a business, you know, I need fiat for my day-to-day expenses. So even though I want to accept Bitcoin, well, what do I do once I've got it? It's like having a lump of gold, you know. It's like, yeah, you could pay me with a gold coin, but I don't know what to do with this. I can't, you know, I can't pay my suppliers with this coin. You know, so do you feel like there might be some solutions that could emerge that fix that, or...?
Yeah, I think that you're right. It is getting into fiat is a problem. And sorry, I didn't, when I said, yeah, $9 tomorrow, I really just meant the next time they go to sort of use it or spend it, it might have gone, that might be a week later or 2 weeks later or something, it's gone down 10% maybe.
Yeah.
You're right, 10% in a day is a huge change, and we don't see that very often anymore.
Yeah.
So yes, that's something that I am interested in. And I've been... there's a few from our talk a few weeks back, there are a few people who said they were interested to help out. And so we've got a small group, and we're looking to hopefully come up with a solution to this problem for the merchants to be able to accept Bitcoin with no risk, because we will ideally liquidate it at point of sale immediately on an exchange to New Zealand dollars, and then guarantee them a certain amount in their bank account the next business day. So I think this is sort of the missing link. And it's not that I want people to liquidate their Bitcoin to New Zealand dollars. That's sort of not what I want at all. But I think, you know, when the internet came out, Skype was a big service initially, because people were making phone calls on their computer through the internet because it was way cheaper. And so it wasn't like, it kind of forced the mobile companies to drop their prices and to catch up, because people stopped using, they stopped using the phone so much, and we're kind of doing more internet communications. I think what we need to do is the same thing. We need to sort of meet the demand on the market where it's at. And that is, at the moment, people won't accept Bitcoin because they don't understand Bitcoin. They don't understand why they need it or why it's important. And so if we make it easier to accept Bitcoin, albeit liquidated to New Zealand dollars, we're sort of an intermediate step to them. You know, a few people come in, and a few Bitcoiners, hopefully real passionate Bitcoiners, come in. They're like, "Well, I can pay in Bitcoin," and they pay, and they take selfies of themselves paying in Bitcoin, and they post on social media. And hopefully, and this part of this is having these meetups where Bitcoiners meet in real life, that BitKiwi guys are facilitating. It's great, because then when a new merchant accepts Bitcoin, the idea would be that, you know, we can announce it to their local Bitcoin meetup, and hopefully those Bitcoiners will go and support that merchant because they're supporting the Bitcoiners' favorite payment method. And then hopefully the merchant should then have the time and inclination to spend a bit more time finding out about Bitcoin on their own time when they've got a chance, and understanding why the Bitcoiners are so passionate about it, and why they come in and pay with it, and they're so excited about it, and then take the time to understand it such that there's the chance that they might then not liquidate all of the Bitcoins to New Zealand dollars and instead save some, which would be great.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Or maybe they go to their suppliers.
No, absolutely, I agree. And I think the idea that, I mean, the perfect solution, you know, everyone's taking Bitcoin, I mean, that's just not going to happen overnight, right? It's going to be the slow transition. And I think that's really where we have to be strategic as New Zealand Bitcoiners and kind of start facilitating that. And certainly what you described, the service, I'd love to hear more about sort of how far along you are with that in terms of the concept. But if that solution was available, I feel like there would be a real opportunity to, really get people on board with it. And in quite a professional sense, you know, I think, you know, having a buddy run a food cart, a food truck or something, you know, sure, he can just do it on his phone and run the FPOS machine on the side, but actually going into an establishment and saying, hey, look, you know, have you thought about Bitcoin? These are the solutions that are available. We can do this bespoke thing to roll this out for you. Here's a point of sale unit that you can use. You don't have to just use a phone. You know, it's all very, I think there's actually a business opportunity there to provide some of that stuff. But you know, here's everything you need to get up and running, because even with FPOS, you know, those cafes, they're just leasing that gear. They have a vendor who comes and services it. They don't they don't necessarily buy it themselves, and so they don't really want to know about it. You know, they just want to be able to get the money. And making that kind of seamless is really important, and making it easy. You know, who do I ring? Look, the thing's gone offline. I can't start Blue Wallet. What's going on? I can't start Breeze. I need to be able to ring somebody up and find out what's going on. I can't be just messing around while the customers are lining up. So I think longer term there is room for a service like that. But certainly having one, having cafes and shops and restaurants in Wellington and all of the cities, because New Zealand's not a very big place, right? There's places that I go, you know, every week for lunch and for coffees and things. If they accepted Bitcoin, I'd be paying Bitcoin, you know, and it would quickly add up, I believe. And I think, again, with the meetups, you know, starting to direct people to places and suddenly they get 20 or 30 people a day come through who are using Bitcoin, that's really going to change the way they approach Bitcoin, I think. And especially when there's the fee piece as well, you know, you look at the 15 cent surcharges you get because you're trying to use PayWave, and you think, well, actually we can avoid all of that completely. I mean, there's obviously some numbers to crunch on what it would look like with you know, getting point of sale units up and running, and what the fees would look like on the service. But I mean, realistically, Rob, I mean, how far away is New Zealand from the service that you describe? This kind of fiat Bitcoin to fiat service, is it blue sky at the, you know, pie in the sky at the moment, or are you guys sort of making progress towards it, or how much can you?
If it was just purely a technical problem, you know, I'll have it ready next week, yeah. Because I could work furiously at it, and I'm a nuts and bolts guy. I kind of, you know, I'm on the tools and I'll do the programming, but unfortunately, there's also a legal and compliance aspect to it, which is it's a bit of a nightmare, because you have to collect essentially the same information about people that the banks collect and store it in a collection somewhere, and then submit it to various agencies should somebody make a suspicious transaction, or the transaction volume amounts be suspicious or be out of the ordinary, or so it's like, it's a bit of a moral conundrum for myself, because what I want is more freedom for everybody. And the sacrifice I have to make is to run a service whereby if people use it, I've got to collect their information and I've got to submit it to the authorities should there be cause to. And so... yeah, is this a good idea? But the way I square it with myself is I say, look, I'm helping people get to freedom. I feel when you have Bitcoin, when you're using Bitcoin, that's freedom. And so if you have to jump through a burning hoop to get to that freedom, that's just what we have to do. And maybe Bitcoin would make it there without any of this service, but I think it would be a slower process. I think it would be... I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong about this. Maybe we need less of these services. But it was interesting you talking to Paul last time, and he said he thinks not in his lifetime will he see the benefits of this. But that's what I want to do, is I want to sort of accelerate Bitcoinization. If we can knock 5 years off the time that it takes to get to the point where I can go to my local cafe and pay in Bitcoin, if I can accelerate that by 5 years by doing this service, then that's a win for me, because that's five more years of sort of rent seeking and inefficiency and that we can kind of dispense with, you know. So it's a tough one, really. Them's the breaks.
No, I hear you, and I think it is important, and I appreciate that you're considering that that moral point of view as well, because it is a challenge to kind of balance these two. And because I think on one end, you know, I've got this kind of absolute kind of conception of what Bitcoin should be, but the reality of it, and having read the Financial Markets Authority website last night, just trying to get my head around how this all works in New Zealand, I understand that, look, there are some requirements, you know, legally speaking, and we do live in a rules-based society. There is a legal system. There's, you know, departments and government, and every single person in Wellington except me pretty much is working for these kind of institutions. And so trying to work within that, I believe my approach is that, yeah, we do need to work with it. And not everyone agrees with that, which is fine. But I certainly think I can imagine a moment, say later this year or whenever it comes online, where, you know, you walk into a place and you've got, you know, some paperwork and you say, hey, look, you know, we want to sign you up for this, you know, it's called Lightning. We want to, you know, we really love to see you have this in your store. And in fact, what we're going to do is we're going to give you this machine to use for 3 months. We're going to set you up with this wallet that you have custody to every day. The money that comes through from Bitcoin is going to be sent straight to your bank account. All I need is, you know, the same details that you use with your bank. You know, my name's Cody. You know, this is my business card. You know, it's all very legitimate. And I think, you know, that's just the way New Zealand is. You know, it's not the Wild West here like it might be in other places. You know, people kind of follow the rules. And that's fine. You know, you want a debit card, you want an FPOS machine, there's a bit of paperwork to fill out. And as long as that data is securely stored and you're enabling them to use Bitcoin, then I think that's a positive for everybody. And ultimately, the customers aren't getting KYC'd, so it's just the vendor who's having to provide some information. And as far as anyone can see, it's just some sats coming in for coffees. So I definitely think it's a valid point for you to kind of think about, but I would love to see this service available myself. You know, I think I could, there's certainly places I could go to, you know, tomorrow and start basically onboarding them to it, because it would have that kind of officialness to it, for lack of a better word. Like, you know, it's not just me saying, hey, you know, download this app, you know, like there's kind of a process to go through, and I think business owners kind of respond well to that.
Oh, well, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. Yeah, I hope. There's another problem, yeah. Which is convincing Bitcoiners to spend their Bitcoins, because we're hodlers, right? We, you know, we're looking to the future. We're trying not to spend. You know, we're like, oh, I could just make that coffee at home instead of going to the cafe and spending it. And yeah, and I think it was it BTC Nautilus, Brendan, who said you can't hope on your customers changing their mind. Your business model can't be based on your customers changing their mindset. So I think it was Brent. Anyway, sorry if I've just put words in your mouth there, mate.
No.
Whoever said that, they're right. Like, I can't, if Bitcoiners aren't prepared to spend their Bitcoins, then this project doesn't get off the ground. And okay, we've got a great store of value, but what we need to do is get rid of the Visa and get rid of the MasterCard. And the way we do that is by using Bitcoin, actually using it. You need to, it's not enough to just hold it. We now need to be, and here I am preaching.
Yeah, no.
Sorry, I'm just a player, but this is what I want to see now. And it took me ages to internalize this myself as well, because I'm a hodler.
Well, no, I mean, it's okay, man. Like there's, I think, complexity to it. And the other thing, it is a complex system, right? It's not black and white. And I think there's flow on effects and second order effects that we don't quite understand yet. And an example of that, one of my New Year's resolutions, which I was writing about, was, you know, my desire to use cash this year. You know, in New Zealand, cash is not really a thing. You know, every transaction I ever made last year was pretty much FPOS. It's just the way it is. In other countries I've been to, obviously cash is still super popular, but here it's just not really that common. But I realized, you know, like it's kind of like use it or lose it. And so I started withdrawing cash at the start of the week to pay for my coffees and my groceries and everything. And I realized, you know, there's something different about this. You know, like it just, I think we the quality of money in its different forms, it sort of has something different about it, which you only kind of get to as you go through the rabbit hole. But I realized it's like, yeah, cash is cool, man. You know, it's sure, I'm it's fiat, but it's like it's the tail of fiat, because I'm going, you know, in my mind I'm on a Bitcoin standard, so it's like, yeah, cash, I'm pegging out to fiat using the cash, and then I burn it within a week. It's not sitting in my bank account. I'm not trying to save in this format. And so as a final settlement device, you know, cash literally it is what it is. There's no phone needed. There's nothing needed. It just works. And so the other thing is thinking, well, cash kind of works, you know, like people just need that as a service, you know. And so it doesn't matter how much cash they print, because you just withdraw more the next day. As long as you're saving in Bitcoin, it doesn't really matter to you, you know. I could do $100 this week, $200 next week, but if it's the same value in Bitcoin, it doesn't matter to me. But and I mean, that's hyperinflation, you know, as a long-term thing. But ultimately, cash, it's kind of like this, like I think of it sort of like this hydraulic fluid between me and the merchant, you know. And so I've got this kind of rock solid gold standard, Bitcoin standard mindset. Whether the vendor has that or not doesn't really matter, but we happen to just be transacting in this very fungible, very easy to handle thing that's kind of resilient. You know, you can put it through the dryer, you can put it through the washing machine, whatever. So, you know, is it even realistic for Lightning to be used when you've got stuff like that available? Or do we have a plurality? You know, we've got different currencies available. You know, you've got, you know, New Zealand dollars, you can just use cash, you give it to me straight away, or you get the Lightning. Maybe, you know, in a distant future, our currency is so devalued, people are asking for Australian dollars instead of New Zealand dollars. It's hard to really predict what it's going to look like. And I think all we can do is try our best to build towards the future we want.
Yeah, I think I liked your idea there about using cash. Now, shamefully, I don't use cash that much myself, and it made me think more about what I should be doing as well. And it's, I think the saying is use it or lose it is the case. And what I did see recently was an advert, I think, for people being able to pay each other more easily using the Visa card just with their phones. So I think the banks are now trying to roll out a thing so people can pay each other with their cards to their phones. And I think they're trying to get us on the way to removing cash. It seems to be going away a little bit.
Well, I'll show something beautiful. So this, I mean, this is the $20. Here's the tip, you know, the QR tip sets, printout. Together, I don't know, just the physicality of it, you know. So this is $20, you know, and it's usable anywhere. We don't need any internet, we don't need anything. It is absolutely it's fully fungible. It just kind of works, you know. And I think I don't know, just withdrawing that, you know, earlier this week and thinking, you know, man, there is something different about this. And when I was writing about it, I said, well, look, this is actually worth more. You know, a dollar isn't a dollar. $20 cash is worth more than $20 on your EFTPOS card, because if I have to pay for something and there's no way to use EFTPOS, you know, maybe I'd pay a premium to be able to pay for that thing still. Maybe it's an emergency. Maybe I have to get that thing. You know, it's the EFTPOS machines are down. I have to fill my car up. If I've got cash, that's worth more than any amount of money you've got on your in your bank account online, because you just, you know, it's not accessible. And so I was saying it's maybe a 2-3% premium on the value of cash. And as you say, you know, use it or lose it. As more and more places become cashless, which I think opens a moral dilemma. You know, I don't know if that's even, I'd have to jump into the New Zealand law and have a look at it. But I feel like turning away legal tender, I don't know. I feel like there has to be some obligation on shops to accept cash. But, you know, you're seeing more and more restaurants and bars saying, you know, look, we're cashless. And it's like, well, what does that mean for someone who's unbanked? You know, and there are people out there like that who don't have banking facilities. Even in New Zealand, people think, oh, no way. But yeah, they are out there. So taking away cash, I think, is a huge human rights issue, huge privacy issue. And of course, the CBDC, which is the kind of the specter that's looming over all of our heads, is this kind of universal format for money that is just going to take away everything, you know, your driver's license, your passport, all of that's going to be on this, the New Zealand digital coin. And I think that future is a lot more, I mean, I'd rather take cash, you know, give me cash futures any day. I don't need a Bitcoin future. I need give me a cash future over the CBDC, because that's just dangerous, I think. And I think that will set us up for huge issues if that goes ahead.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you there. I'm pretty concerned about CBDCs, because I think they've got to get us out of the mess that they're currently in. They can either carry on printing more and more money and we can go to hyperinflation, or we can go to some kind of ridiculous austerity. Both of these options are pretty bad. Or if they introduce CBDCs, they can essentially control your spending. So they can throttle your own spending. They can say, like, you know, you can only spend X amount this week, or, you know, you jumped on a plane yesterday, you can't buy steak tomorrow, or this kind of thing. It's the way I see that this potential situation we could get ourselves in because of the convenience of, and the reason we don't use cash is because of the convenience of card, right? You just wave your card and ping, it's gone, and all right, you pay extra money and there's surveillance added, but you don't notice any of that because of the convenience. And that's, I guess, why we have to make Bitcoin more convenient. And that's what we need to do. So I'm fully on board. I agree. I'm concerned about CBDCs as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is important to discuss, and I think I appreciate that there is an educational aspect to that as well. So, look, man, I think we've covered a lot of the stuff that I wanted to talk to you about today, and I know it's sort of our first time chatting properly about a lot of this stuff, but I appreciate you, you know, sharing your thoughts and sort of what you're working on, and also being public, I think, is really something I really respect. You know, you put your name out there. You know, you're offering these, you know, this Bitcoin educational stuff. You're running a few other things, and you're putting your name out to it. And I think in the Bitcoin world, a lot of people sort of are behind these sort of usernames and handles, and they're not publicly putting themselves out there. But that's something that you've done, and I think that gives it a little bit of a face, a bit of humanity, which is kind of what we need. I think, you know, an authentic person you can go and chat to. And kind of get advice and rely on, you know, it's not just some Twitter username. So that's really great.
Well, thank you very much, Cody. I appreciate it.
No, all good. So look, we might wrap it up.
I want to thank you for doing the podcast. I've been really enjoying it. It's great to hear like something local. And I think it's awesome. And so, yeah, look forward to the next ones you do with other people around New Zealand about Bitcoin.
Yeah,
it's great.
No, thank you. You know, I have a bit of a plan. It's sort of one of my other New Year's resolutions is to really develop this, and I feel like the response has been really awesome. People have been streaming to the show and just really kind of shouting out and supporting it. So that's really great. But look, one final thing, Rob, is in terms of what you're working on and what you'd like to share, is there any links or places you'd like to send people for your educational stuff with Bitcoin or your other projects?
Yeah, you could go to learnbitcoin.nz, which I'm hoping to have an online course at some stage, which I don't have at the moment. I've done some recording, which I'm not happy with, so I need to, I'm working on that at the moment. But if you're in the local area and you're keen to do a course, there will be one going up there. The other place could potentially be acceptbitcoin.nz, but unfortunately it's kind of a bit of a mishmash of information. It doesn't look very nice at the moment. I don't have very good design skills such as yourself, but hopefully at some stage it'll be look a bit more presentable, and if I can get some help from the community, that would be great. Yeah. But those are the two places, so thanks for that.
Absolutely sweet. All right, well, thanks, Rob, and take care.
Thanks a lot, Cody. Catch you.